Bobbig.
Yeah, welcome to the talk of Lars Hiepel about JavaScript, Rust, Python, and the Holy Grail. Lars is consultant with InnoQ and Manik, and he loves to enjoys programming in and talking about Haskell, Prolog, and Rust. And yeah, let's listen to him and enjoy his talk.
Thank you so much. I am well aware that I'm the only thing separating you from your well-deserved dinner, so I will try to speak very quickly and get this over with. The talk is entitled JS, Rust, Python, the Holy Grail, or Holy Graal, and the painting in the background is entitled Quest for the Holy Grail, and that's got nothing to do with the talk, except for the fact that I presume that this is also what it looked like when the Graal VM was conceived. There was probably some horses involved or something. But before I get to the main subject of this talk, which is the Graal VM, I would like to take you on a journey all the way back to when Java was initially released. So this is a quote from a very funny blog post from James Irie. James Gosling invents Java. Java is a relatively verbose, garbage-collected, class-based, statically typed, single-dispatch, object-oriented programming language with single implementation inheritance and multiple interface inheritance. Sun loudly heralds Java's novelty. So this is how James Irie describes this. Programming language from 1996. And this is James Gosling, and this is Sun Microsystems. I'm not sure who still remembers. Yes, somebody remembers. Awesome. Yes. Unfortunately, I forgot to bring my Sun Microsystems t-shirt. I only realized this morning. It's a missed opportunity. But Java actually came, the first JVM actually came out in 1994. And it's got that idea that you have bytecode, and then you can run that bytecode you have to compile to that bytecode once, and then you can run that bytecode wherever a JVM is available. However, for a very long time, Java was the only programming language that actually ran on the JVM. So that was the only compiler that was there. And in 2001 were there attempts to bring other programming languages onto the JVM. Although the JVM bytecode was not strictly only for Java, it took quite a while for other languages to target. JSON and JRuby came out in 2001. I'm not sure if anybody uses those. I think they were used much more heavily in the past. But JSON, for example, is still on Python 2.7, so it's basically completely outdated. I'm not sure about JRuby, if there's any recent versions for that. But my impression was that JSON and JRuby were a successful experiment at some time, but probably not as much in use anymore. But still, they demonstrated that you could run not statically typed languages on the JVM. 2003 then was the first version of Groovy. Has anyone used Groovy so far? Quite a lot of people. I'm presuming Jenkins plugins. I think that's the main use case for Groovy. Groovy actually started out as a specification proposal for the Java language to get rid of some of the static types and make stuff more dynamic. Put some more syntax sugar in there, but eventually the proposal was dropped and was just developed as its own programming language. Oh, I forgot, it's not just Jenkins, also Gradle configurations, yes, of course. Now, 2004, as you can see, more languages start appearing with a faster turnaround time. The first version of Scala was released, obviously one of my very favorite languages, and Scala was a language that had even stronger static types than Java. So all of these, what you've seen before, tried to like remove some of the typing, and Scala actually added some more typing on top. All right, so 2 years later, 2006, there was the Java 6 release. And Java 6 was notable in that sense that it had this JSR223, also known as scripting API, built-in. And the scripting API basically gave you a uniform interface for running arbitrary scripts on your JVM, right? So you could provide, on the one side, library authors could provide scripting languages, and then you could write scripts in those languages, and then through this uniform API, you could just like add stuff, add programming language to your Java program. And the question is like, why would you want that? Well, initially this was motivated by having servlets, but wanting to program in PHP. That's literally in the proposal. Like, servlets are cool, but we really want to program our web application on a JVM in PHP. I'm not sure why they put that in the proposal, but that was the motivation. And I always thought that like Java and PHP programs are like oil and water. They don't mix, but apparently that was, I'm not sure, maybe they wanted to get soap to mix that. But regardless, their solution was to define this API, and one of the main selling points of that API was that you could exchange objects between the JVM world, the Java world, and those other languages. Now, they were talking in this proposal about scripting languages. Unfortunately, they didn't really define what they understand as scripting language. And I'm pretty sure they would call like Python, Python would probably be a part of the definition. Although, if you look at real existing Python codebase, for example, you wouldn't really call it a scripting language anymore, right? You can write like big applications, not necessarily scripts. But the wording kind of implies that you were talking about untyped languages. That was really the main goal. There were implementations of this JSR for typed languages, but the way it reads kind of suggests that they were really into untyped languages. And the fundamental problem with those is that most function calls, or other kinds of calls, they require reflection in the JVM, but they're really slow. And they sort of said, like, you know, language implementers, like if you implement a Python language for this JSR, you just have to live with that, right? So just implement it using reflection, that's fine. All right, so that's 2006. Then for a long time, nothing really happened from a programming language perspective. And then in 2011, the next Java version came out. So as you can see, there was like a 5 years distance back then between two Java major releases. Now you would have 10 releases in that same time span. And there was another JSR implement there, number 292, and that one was talking about invoke, or this one was specifying invoke dynamic. So let me explain what the idea behind that was. In 2007, still Sun at the time, created an experimental VM they called DaVinci Machine, and that DaVinci Machine was basically like a dumping ground for all sorts of different experiments. For efficiency, for example, they had tail calls implemented there. They wanted to do continuations and stuff, but they also had this thing about dynamic invocation. And before I explain to you what it is, I just want to show you the beauty of one of the slides from Sun Microsystems that introduced this. So you have the Chinese wall here, and you have Duke the mascot somehow attached to DaVinci flying machine transferring over the I'm not sure what the metaphor here is supposed to be, but that's just what the slide looked like. So let's talk about this dynamic invocation business. So the problem is, scripting languages are really cool, but usually they're duck typed. So when you have X plus Y, you don't really know what the heck X plus Y means, right? Could be any of it. Could be one of those things, right? No idea. Right? So it could also return object. So if X is an object and Y is an array, for example, it could be arbitrary stuff, right? You don't know what it is. So the solution is that the JVM provides you with tools to kind of specify your own custom method and operator dispatcher, right? So usually in the JVM, what happens, the default is a virtual call. So you know the name of the method, you know where in which interface it was defined, you know the types of the arguments, and then the only thing you need to figure out if someone had overridden this implementation. So you look at the vtable, and it's like two jumps, done. But here, what they want to do is they want to give you full flexibility, like you can implement your own logic, and if you need three jumps, that's fine, just do it. And they wanted to try to make that somehow efficient. But that's the motivation behind this. So I've copied this diagram from a research paper about this. The basic idea is that invocations are now two steps, and whenever you do the invocation first, you do both steps, and when you do it again, you may be able to omit the first step. So what are the two steps? So the first step is, instead of directly actually calling your method. You use this invoke dynamic, and then you call the so-called bootstrap method. And that can be, this is something that the language implementer has to provide. Now, this bootstrap method basically says, well, let me figure out what method to actually call now. Let me figure out the call site of this thing that you want to do, like x plus y. And basically, it can figure out, well, I'm calling this f here or this g or whatever. And I'm returning, for example, here a constant call site, which means every time you see this invocation, always return g, always call g. Right? So it's like an instruction that's handed back to the JVM. So JVM asks, I have x plus y here, what should I do? And the bootstrap method says, always call g. Right? So the JVM does it for the first time, and then it will actually bind this, or link this, to this call site. So whenever it sees that, it will go straight away to g. So you can skip this bootstrap for the next time, which means it makes it much faster. Right? So every starting from the second invocation, it will always be efficient by directly going to g. But there's also some bells and whistles. For example, you can tell it to attach some conditions. So you can say, well, actually, it's not a constant call site. It's like a variable call site. And it's g most of the time. But if there's some condition violated, then ask me again or something like that. You can do that. So if it's non-constant, it can also get relinked. And fun fact, these method handles have kind of an interface that allows you to encode an entire Turing machine in it. So it has like loop combinators and stuff. So you can say, this method handle repeats this other method handle for this method handle time. So this is possible. I'm not sure why you would want that, but I've been told that people have implemented entire programming language just in a single method handle. So just to give you an idea how powerful this thing is. And basically what happens is that JVM tries to inline this as far as possible and just make it efficient. All right, so this is cool, but the problem is this is really hard to implement. So let's say you're working in your day job, and you think, actually, it would be nice to have a domain-specific language for this problem. Let me implement an efficient compiler for that. And then next thing you know is you're looking in the JVM language spec and you're figuring out how the hell to implement an efficient bootstrap method. That's really not that cool. GraalVM will fix that. But before we get to GraalVM, I have two more stops in the history book. 2014, Java 8 came out with Nathorn. And Nathorn was is still a JavaScript engine. It will be deprecated soon, I think, and removed. And Nathorn used this invoke dynamic, so you could start to efficiently execute JavaScript. So they used it, it was fine. I'm not sure what other languages also use invoke dynamic. Probably a lot of them. And then finally, 2019, the first version of GraalVM came out. And GraalVM kind of tries to revolutionize this entire idea of running different languages on the top of the JVM. And it's developed by Oracle, and it's got tons of features. And I'm going to focus in this talk about the specific feature that is very nice if you want to implement a programming language. And that feature is called Truffle. So what is Truffle? If you look at their website, this is how they describe it. Truffle framework allows you to run programming language efficiently on GraalVM. It simplifies language implementation by automatically deriving high-performance code from interpreters. So that sounds kind of intriguing. Like, if you've learned something in like a compiler construction course or some other software engineering course, whatever, people will tell you that like writing an interpreter is usually kind of easy. Like, you just have a method that basically looks at all the different cases of your syntax and then like runs this. But it's also kind of slow, right? And what they're talking about here is now automatically deriving high-performance code from interpreters. So you can write some slow interpreter code, and then you have to do nothing, and then GraalVM makes it efficient. That's cool, right? So you can be done much faster with the implementation. Okay, when I first read that, it sounded a little bit like magic, and I can assure you it is magic, but I want to try to give you some insights into how this magic actually works under the hood. Okay, so I'm sure most of you are familiar with what currying is. Currying basically means that if you have a function that takes two arguments, here you have a function that takes an A and a B and returns a C, what you can do is you can partially apply that function if you already know the A. Right? And what you get back is you specify an A, and what you get back is you get back a function that only takes one argument, B, and then returns a C. So far, so good. Now, in most programming languages, there's some kind of syntax to do that. But what they probably don't do is they won't evaluate anything at this point. It's like basically some kind of pointer in memory. And only when you specify the B, then the entire computation will run. That's the standard case, right? So this is basically a very efficient operation because it does nothing. It only creates like a pointer in memory saying like, oh, in case you read a B, take this A, which I have saved, and that B, and then run the computation. Now, this is partial application. Very careful now. Partial evaluation is the same thing, but it will actually run the stuff that it can. Right? So assuming the function can already do something with the A, maybe look up some stuff in a table or whatever, then it will do that. Like, it will try to evaluate this binary function as much as possible, leaving you the so-called residue of this function. So the B to C that gets out basically has no traces of the A left anymore. It's evaluated as far as possible. And compilers do that all the time. So we have all sorts of things that compilers do to an innocent program, like constant folding. I think there was a talk that mentioned this today already. Inlining, dead code elimination, all of that stuff. So all of these are things that can be described as partial evaluation. Right? The compiler will not actually run the full program for you. It will not tell you the entire output. It can't do that because it requires some input. But it can look at the static structure of a program and try to figure out if there's stuff it can optimize away. And that's partial evaluation. And I want to give you a concrete example here. And that example would be for loop unrolling. So I can already tell you this is a multiplication function. It's completely stupid. You wouldn't implement it that way, but just bear with me for the sake of this example. We have a function f that takes an x and a y, and it returns the product of x and y. And how it does that is it creates some kind of accumulator, and then it loops from 0 to x and just adds y on top of that. And then we would, for example, call that in Java, we would have maybe a stream of integers, and then we map f3y. So we would basically multiply all the values in the stream by 3. So far, so good. Now, a sufficiently smart compiler could now start to optimize this. And it would try to perform loop unrolling. Right? So it's going to pull the loop and pull as long as so that no loop is left. So for example, it would recognize that f is always called with x is equal to 3. So it would generate a specialized version of f where x is set to 3. So you have a function left that only takes one argument. And also knows that the loop is executed 3 times, so it will just copy the body of the loop 3 times. And you get plus equal y, and so on, 3 times, and then you get the result there. So no loops left, which is good because the CPU doesn't have to perform jumps. So in general, this would be a positive performance optimization. Of course, CPUs are much more complicated than that, but like, just assume that this is better in every way. Now it could also look at the actual implementation here, what actually goes on under the hood, and could, for example, recognize that there's this 3 times y. It could do that, and I'm pretty sure that GCC and LLVM, they do all of that. They're actually pretty advanced with their optimizations. And then finally, a compiler could also perform inlining, so there's no residue of the function left. You basically just get this 3 times y. And maybe there's also some weird assembly instruction that does that all in one thing, maybe, I don't know, but that's the general idea. Now, this is pretty cool, because compiler can use these techniques to produce much more efficient bytecode. And what the raw VM people said is, well, all of these compiling optimizations, they're really just partial evaluation under the hood, right? So, compiler writers have to do a lot of work to implement optimizations. Wouldn't it be better if we just implemented partial evaluation once and for all, and then call it a day and go home, right? Then we would have fixed all the compiler optimizations. Of course, reality is not that simple, but that's the bottom line, what they're trying to achieve. Okay, any questions up until here? Good. Now let's get back to the initial quote from the website where they claim that you can just write an interpreter and you get high efficient code. Let's first talk about what a compiler and an interpreter is. A compiler is the thing that transforms a program in two different steps. First step would be to take the source code, apply some transformations, and you get some target code or intermediate code, however you want it, however you want to call it. And then you feed that target code into a runtime. That runtime could be the operating system, it could be the JVM, it could be something else. And then the runtime also reads the input, like from standard in, and then it prints something like printing stuff on standard out. That's a compiler. And it doesn't really matter what the target code here is, just assume it's JVM bytecode. An interpreter, on the other hand, collapses that into a single step. So an interpreter directly takes source code and feeds it into the runtime and produces output depending on what input you give it. What the GraalVM people want to do now is let's say you invent a cool language, like the Bob language. And you want to execute this Bob language, so you write an interpreter. So you write this runtime. And then what the GraalVM tries to do is give you this automatically, right? So that would be pretty cool. And it turns out that the people at Oracle, they weren't the first people to think of this. In fact, there's this paper that is called Partial Evaluation of Computation Process, an Approach to a Compiler-Compiler. And a compiler-compiler is basically a thing that gives you a compiler, right? And that is a pretty futuristic thing. And it's called so-called Futamura projection. I'm hoping that I'm not violating any copyrights with that slide. So this paper is quite old. It's from the 80s. And what this professor, Futamura, basically said is he conjectured that there could be such a thing. So he defined this Futamura projection, what he calls it. And what it basically does is you have source code from the Bob language, and then somehow directly you end up with a compiled program without any compiler involved, right? And then you can run this and it's as efficient as a compiled program, but there's no compiler involved, right? Does it make sense? Maybe. In the paper, he doesn't really explain how you could do that, right? It's just conjecturing that that could be possible. And it turns out that there's even a complete hierarchy of these projections. So this is the normal thing, like small brain. You write an interpreter, and the interpreter turns code into a result. Okay, cool. The first Futamura projection is it's a machine that looks at code and an interpreter and gives you an efficient executable. That's basically what the GraalVM does. But Futamura didn't stop there. So he also conjectured a second Futamura projection, which is taking an entire interpreter without actually looking at the code that it's supposed to interpret and turning that into a compiler, right? So there's no specific, so you see here, first question is you still need to look at the concrete code that you want to execute, so it's kind of an interpreter specialized to a particular program. Here, you don't even need that, it's just like, take the entire interpreter, put it in, get the compiler out. And there's even a third one, so now we're reaching galaxy brain status. It's a machine that takes a machine that turns interpreters into compilers and gets back a universal interpreter compiler compiler. So that's the third, obvious, right? And it turns out there's even a research paper that's just called Is There a Fourth Futamura Projection? Wikipedia says no. I haven't read the paper if they come to a different conclusion. Yeah, and the point is that this is Futamura. He has a website that looks like you would imagine a Japanese university professor website to look like. And he wrote this paper in the 80s, and he didn't really know how to do this. It was way too advanced to implement it at the time. Now, the people at Oracle, they came and looked at this. Actually, the people who conceived GraalVM weren't at Oracle at the time, but Oracle kind of bought this group. They thought, maybe we should do that. Maybe we should put that on the JVM. And they did that, and now we have rainbows and unicorns. Now we just have, we just need to write an interpreter, and then we get efficient code back, right? Efficient target code. Wouldn't that be nice? Now, of course, reality is more messy, so it's not all rainbows and unicorns, it's just rainbows, no unicorns, unfortunately. And what they did is they created this GraVM, which is kind of like a JVM on steroids, so it's just like a regular JVM, it can run Java bytecode as the normal OpenJDK, and then it can also do a bunch of other stuff. So this is a slide I took from their website. The basic idea is that you have sort of like an execution platform that can take arbitrary languages in and run it on, well, not so arbitrary platforms, right? So this path, running Java code on the JVM, that would be the default, right? That would be something that you would usually do on the JVM. But you can also run JavaScript code on the JVM, or you can run Python code on the JVM, and also you can run these things on JVM. I have a slide prepared for that also, but let's first talk about these things. And if you give Oracle a lot of money, you can also run this stuff on Node.js, or you could run Java code on Node.js, or you could also run it as stored procedures in your Oracle DB, right? So this is possible. This is possible. You can write Python code that manipulates stuff in your Oracle DB, and not just Python code, but Python code that calls JavaScript code. All of this is possible, and it's kind of seamless, because they picked the same idea as this Java scripting API, that you have a common understanding of what objects are, and you can pass them around kind of seamlessly. There's an entire object protocol that they have defined, and that object protocol allows you to pass along objects between those different languages. Now, of course, when I say arbitrary input languages, that's not entirely true, because all of these arrows require an implementation, right? So you can't just give it APL code and expect to know what it should do, right? Not even humans can do that. So, of course, somebody's got to implement how JavaScript works. But what's really cool is that in the free version, the open source version of GraVM, a lot of these things work, and they test their stuff pretty rigorously. So, for example, for the JavaScript code, for the JavaScript interpreter, they run regression tests like hundreds of NPM packages, and you can be pretty confident that whatever GraVM or GraJS does is the same thing with what Node.js does, which is pretty cool because now it's sort of a drop-in replacement. And they've implemented even the entire Node.js API, so you can like require FS and do stuff with promises and whatnot. All of this works. Right. So on the next slide, I have an actual code snippet from the GraJS implementation. And it's extremely stripped down, but there's still a lot going on. But don't worry, I will take you through this line by line. So if someone here has already implemented an interpreter in an object-oriented language, the way this usually works is you define an interface for an abstract syntax tree, like some expression or whatever, and then you provide an execute function, and then you implement this interface with all different kinds of expressions that you have. This is a snippet that defines how to multiply two objects in JavaScript. And as we can see, it extends from binary nodes, so we know the execute function needs to take two arguments. And this is abstract, right? So we don't give an implementation here, we just say, well, in JavaScript you can multiply anything with literally everything else. It's just objects, and you get back whatever object. And then what you do is you just implement all the different cases that are supported. So I've taken some cases here for integers and doubles, so just for numbers. There's like hundreds of lines more in there for arrays and objects and whatever. There's still much more stuff in here. But I think what you can see here is that you can attach these conditions here. Like you can say, this is for two ints, and also, this method should be called when b is larger than 0, because somehow there could be more efficient. I don't know, I'm not a compiler author, but they have determined that If b is greater than 0, they can do something different than when b is not greater than 0. So they have a fallback here. And you can also say stuff like, well, if there's an arithmetic exception, then do some other stuff. So you can also put other kinds of conditions there. And then for double, apparently the best thing you can do is just run the JVM multiplication operation, like just the double multiply bytecode, JVM. And basically what they do is as kind of a supercharged just-in-time compilation. So when you feed some JavaScript code into this interpreter, they will basically look at whatever this code does. So it will just interpret it in the first few iterations. And then when they see some patterns, they will replace that by this implementation here. And then they will provide some hooks to rewrite this in case something failed. So that's just regular just-in-time compilation for you. But they were quite smart about this. And this is obviously not the Futamura projection, right? The Futamura projection does not say anything about just-in-time or like statistic looking at branches or whatever. But in practice, they are pretty good. They are pretty close to a real Futamura projection. And when you look at their performance numbers, it's kind of exciting because they have not... So the entire GraalVM is not specific to JavaScript or to Ruby or to Python. They just implemented these interpreters with the Truffle API, and then without further ado, they got comparable performance to, for example, Node.js. Right? So Node.js is based on the V8 engine, and like hundreds of people have poured hundreds of weeks into optimizing for JavaScript code, right? And they have like a specific virtual machine that's pretty fast now. And same goes for other browser vendors, like for Mozilla and whatever. They have JS engines that are super optimized. And they have now kind of a generic interpreter thingy that achieves comparable performance with relatively little specific optimization, right? So of course, if you implement a language, you still need to know what the cases are here, but you don't have to write a just-in-time compiler that looks at code and emits x86 bytecode or whatever. You don't have to do that. They do that for you. And I find that to be pretty exciting, even though they haven't technically implemented the Futamura projection. It's getting pretty close, though. But that's not all, because while efficient code execution is cool, I think there's also a lot of potential in the polyglot aspect of it. So languages may call each other. So you can have, like, in the same stack trace, you can have JavaScript code and Java code and Python and whatever. And I think it's pretty exciting. Languages also benefit from the JVM. So for example, the Python and the JavaScript interpreters, they usually have only one thread. You can't like easily parallelize your code. On the other hand, the JVM can easily do that. So it's no problem to run two different JavaScript processes at the same time, or even control threads from within JavaScript. Also, you get all the libraries you get the union of all the libraries of these ecosystems, right? So if you want to run an NPM library in your Java code, you can just do that, or vice versa. Right, so in my opinion, this is a kind of a green field for more experimentation to figure out what the use cases for this could be. And I think the future could be pretty exciting. Now, the stuff I told you before, like about JavaScript and stuff, that is, in my opinion, recommended for production usage. So the GraalJS implementation, run it on your machines, it's fine. I will take full ownership if something fails, because it won't. On the other hand, what follows now, for the rest of the like 5 minutes I still have, is extremely experimental. Do not do that. In fact, do the opposite of what I'm telling you right now. My employer will not take any responsibility if your servers burn. Like, you have been warned, right? This is on record. Because what the GraalVM people have done is they thought, so running scripting languages and JavaScript, whatever, is cool, but what if we could run C++ on the JVM? Right? And they actually went ahead and did it. And And what they did was they wrote an interpreter for LLVM bitcode. And the problem is as follows. If you don't give Oracle money, the execution of LLVM bitcode is unsandboxed. So if you do some pointer arithmetic, your JVM will crash. This is bad. Nobody wants that. So what I thought, what if we take a safe programming language and run that on GraalVM, because then I don't have to give Oracle money in order to not crash my JVM. So I took Rust, and I thought we could compile Rust to LLVM, and then run that on a JVM. And I even created a fancy logo for this. Does anybody recognize the two components of this logo? So this is Duke, the Java mascot, and these are the hands from Ferris the Crab, which is the Rust logo, and this is like Duke Crab Hands or something. and I gave the project a name, and the project is called Rüschtigraben. And Rüschtigraben is, again, a pun, I'm sorry. It's a pun on the so-called Rüschtigraben. So Rüschtigraben is a concept in Switzerland. It separates the German and the French-speaking parts of Switzerland. So Graben is like sort of a border, and Rüschtig is the thing you can eat. And on the German side, you eat the thing, and on the French side, you don't eat the thing. So the Rüschtigraben separates these two parts. And the same goes for like LLVM bitcode and the Java world, right? So there's this border between them. And in the interest of like mixing things up, I said, let's call this Rüschtigraben, because now you can eat Rusty on the JVM. I don't know. and I have actually prepared a demo for this. And this is, again, highly experimental. I want to show you the code that I'm actually executing here. I'm not going to show you all the guts of this. I think this may be a little too large, actually. Let's put a little bit more on here. So I thought, Rust is nice, but what it really needs is an enterprise logging framework. And I thought SLF4j, which is the standard logging meta framework for JVM, would be cool to integrate this. And also, I don't trust the random number generator of Rust, so I want to use the one from Scala. Obviously, right? I mean, I just woke up one morning and thought I want to do this. So Rust also has kind of a logging abstraction, and they just implemented that logging I banged my head a lot when doing this. And I implemented this with an adapter that actually calls into the JVM. And then I take this entire code, so what it basically does is like it instantiates, it loads a type, creates an instance. There's still a bit of unsafe going on here. I plan to make that safe in my Perturitus free time. And yeah, then you call next int on this. See this beautiful null termination here. It's extremely great. And basically what I'm doing here is I'm generating a random number from 0 to 20 exclusive. And then I say the number is whatever. And all of the usual Rust features work, right? So I can allocate strings, and I can format the strings, and all of that is kind of seamless. And in order to add insult to injury, I'm building this with SBT, the Scala build tool. And SBT actually calls Cargo, the Rust build tool, because obviously, right? So fingers crossed, it works. It prints hello world, and it actually prints that the random number is 4, as it should. To demonstrate that it's not just hard-coded, I can run it again, and I'll get 19, so it actually works. And if I clean this, it should be possible to see that, yeah, you see cargo going on here? There's cargo going on within SBT, and then compiling this to bitcode, and then loading that bitcode into the JVM and running it. So that's a thing that works. I'm not sure why one should do that, but like, I just thought, like, wouldn't it be neat if this could happen? Yeah, and it did happen, and I think that's pretty great. Although I still don't have a use case. If you have a use case, I'm really interested in that. So please let me know after the talk, which is now.
Yeah, thank you very much. Are there some questions?
Amazing talk, really amazing.
Thanks.
Aren't you scared that there's like Oracle behind it?
That's a fair question. And yes, Oracle took a lot of heat in the past for how it exercised stewardship of the Java platform. And the fact is nobody knows how Oracle will behave in the long term. However, the fact that they open sourced large parts of the GraalVM is making me very positive about this. And also, one thing I haven't actually mentioned in the talk at all is that there's other parts, other features of GraalVM. For example, the ability to generate native images from Java code, like just native binaries. And people are really getting into this because of microservices. So you don't want like your like whatever stuff you have in the cloud, because you don't want to have high startup times. So people are using GraalVM for this kind of stuff. And actually, parts of these features have now permeated into the official OpenJDK. So I'm kind of personal opinion is that Oracle could see the GraalVM as like an experimental testing ground for stuff that could go into the official JDK, which makes me really positive about the future. Of course, if you're pessimistic and think that Oracle is evil, then I don't know what to say. I have no arguments to disprove that. But it's an extremely fair question, and I would probably suggest like, if you want to implement stuff or like run 100 millions of business on this, probably like, no, look at this for 2 more years and see where it's then at that point.
Some other questions?
Just an add-on. The people behind this are from Oracle Research, and they are mostly academics, and they're extremely cool. You should definitely watch their talks. And I get the impression that Oracle Research is run very differently than Oracle proper.
It's like BuzzFeed and BuzzFeed News. They're actually really different. BuzzFeed News
and
they're really good. Yes? It's slightly late, but I have to ask a question. Maybe I get it wrong, but is it also compiling to WASM so I can run Java code in my browser? Maybe I'm mixing it up. I'm not sure.
I actually don't know. There's an experimental WASM interpreter for Truffle. But I'm not entirely. I would have to look that up. I'm actually not sure if it can produce. Yeah.
How would you rate the overall developer ergonomics of using GraalVM? So you gave the example of compiling to a single binary, which really makes deployment simpler.
Yeah.
Are there other aspects where it's easier to use than in JVM?
I mean, if GraalVM can sort of function as a drop-in replacement of JVM, right? So you can just install it on your machine and never notice it at all. It just works like a regular JVM. But the fact is you only need it if you need the additional features, like native image and the Truffle API. Otherwise, I'm not aware what other killer features there might be in. But I mean, it's like a proper superset of the JVM.
I think it's a little bit faster.
Possibly, yeah. Although much of that just-in-time compilation machinery has also permeated into the proper JVM now.
Some other questions? Okay. Everybody's hungry. So yeah, thank you again for your great talk.